Let's look at the Gemara again. I mean, the question is, like our general question is, what is, how could we define Kavanah? Well, how would it? So the Mishnah says, Kovid Rosh, right? Ein omdim with palel ele mitoch Kovid Rosh. Kovid Rosh is not perfectly clear what Kovid Rosh is. Now, one of the opinions, the Gemara seems to go in the direction of saying you shouldn't be lightheaded, you shouldn't tell jokes, you shouldn't be overly joyous. Well, the Rambam makes a distinction in Hilchos Yom Tov and in the halachas of Sukkah. The Rambam makes a distinction between simcha, which is a positive thing, and holalut, which is a negative thing. The only thing the Rambam doesn't exactly explain is when you go from one to the other. You know, when simcha turns into holalut. But I guess there are certain definitions, you know, that people, like communal sociological definitions. But there is this idea in the halachic system that simcha could turn into holalut, and that's a bad thing. That's a bad thing. In fact, one of the arguments, the early arguments of those who were opposed to Hasidim, they weren't Litvaks. They were just opposed to Hasidut. It was that Hasidut emphasized the holulut. Like, you can't imagine a Chassid without thinking of somebody drinking a little schnapps. Right? It just doesn't work. So there's a story about the Baal Shem Tov, about the Isser of Chodosh. You know, it's a very popular Isser today. But it's machlokas tanoin whether there's an Isser of Chodosh in Chutz Laaretz or not. So in Europe, the Mishnah Berurah writes, in Europe, that people didn't pay too much attention to this problem because it was very difficult to know when the wheat that was used to make the bread you were eating was actually grown and harvested. Because if the wheat was harvested in Siberia and the bread was made in Poland, it was a little hard to make that determination. So they didn't pay much attention. But here, you know, there were always these nudniks. So the nudniks came to the Baal Shem Tov, supposedly, and said to the Baal Shem Tov.
Not me.
Might be your phone number.
I can't believe it. No one ever calls me. Well, my wife.
I'm in for the
Yeah. I'm teaching. That's good.
Hadash.
Now I'm going to turn it off. I can't believe it. Nobody's called me in years. So I came to the Baal Shem and they said, "What about the sister of Chodosh in Chutz Laaretz?" So he thought and he said, "If we had to stop drinking beer, there would be no Hasidus left." So that's just a joke. But you get the idea. So some of the opposition to Hasidut from various circles, right? None of which were really Misnagdim. Misnagdim didn't exist in those times. They were just the people who became Hasidim and everybody else who didn't become a Chassid. So the opposition to Hasidut, which in the beginning was quite volatile, the opposition to Hasidut included the fact that Hasidim were a little bit rangy. They're a little bit, everything went with drinking. Everything they did went with drinking. In fact, you know that the difference between Yahrzeit, the way celebrated by non-Hasidim, and celebrated by Hasidim, ad hayom hazeh. Non-Hasidim, when they have a Yahrzeit, they often fast and learn something, right? Two depressing acts. But Hasidim, they bring cake and cookies and a little matzke and a little, they're happy as a lark.
This is a Hasidic shul.
This shul, why? They
had
did it.
Yesterday.
Yeah, well, there's a certain overlap. Today there's a certain overlap after where peace was established between the Hasidim and the non-Hasidim. So today, everybody's at peace, even though they look different. They sort of like take on the minhagim of the other. And so the yeshiva guys made the Rashi yeshiva into rebbes. Right? Because they also wanted to have rebbes. It was like a good thing. So they became, the yeshiva guys said, you know, okay, you know, seems like drinking beer on Thursday night is a good idea, so let's do it. You know, so there was a kind of an overlap. And in fact, it's interesting that if you look in Yerushalayim at Hasidic yeshivas, you know, Hasidic yeshivas are yeshivas where the students all wear their coats while they're learning. That's a Hasidic yeshiva. A Litvish yeshiva take their jackets off. That's why the Hasidic yeshivas all had air conditioning before the Litvish yeshivas. This is a fact. In fact, they made it possible for people who might have thought that having air conditioning is like giving in to Havle Ha'olam Hazeh, you know, since the Hasidim did it, everybody could do it. I mean, the Vishnitz of Beis Medrash in Bnei Brak, which is something that if you've never seen it, you should take a look. You know, like the Hasidim had this thing about being fancy and, you know, style. I mean, talk about the region, though, that where they had gold. The Rebbe had wallpaper that was gold leaf. So I guess he heard that the Tsar of Russia did that. So he figured he should do that. He had a wagon, you know, that had gold inlay in it. Like, you imagine a car that had gold doors. Real gold. I mean, they didn't have fake gold in those days. So he had these. So I think when it comes to being humble, the Litvaks still have a little bit of it. The Hasidim are not into that. They're not into that kind of humility. What?
I have a question. On the issue of Kovod Rosh, don't we have a precept that says Ibdu Echa Shem Simcha and Ibdu Avoda Tvila is Avoda? So why can't we approach it with Simcha rather than with Kovod Rosh?
I think you can. Your question is Kovod Rosh in the Mishnah exclusive? Is that like the only ingredient that there is that you have to use in order to get to proper davening? But it could be that Kovod Rosh is an element, and that in those days and time of the Mishnah it was very important. But we know that there is the Gemara at the bottom of the page, which the Rambam doesn't mention. The Rambam says, I mean, the Gemara says, Amar Rabbo Begila Shom Temrada, that's five lines from the bottom, Abai Hayayativ Kameh, the Rabba Chazaya, the Abba Kabodak, Tuva, he was laughing and telling jokes, Amar Begilu Bir Oda, where's your Ra'ada? That's what he said, that the Simcha has to be kind of modified by Ra'ada, Tiv, right? So you have to have both. Amar Le'a Nat Filim Anachna. So this is like an interesting idea. I'm wearing tefillin, so I can do whatever I want. You know, I can be as jovial and seemingly irrelevant or irreverent as possible, because if you're wearing tefillin, so you're accepting the Ol Malchus Shemayim. And some accepting the Ol Malchus Shemayim is... And then you have a few stories about Simcha, and the Gemara comes to this interesting point. You see the Tanna Rabbanan, and daf lamed aleph lamed aleph ein omdim litpalel, right? There's a brayta, right? So, like that's how the Gemara goes. You know, after the Gemara explains the words in the Mishnah, so the Gemara will quote always parallel sources that elucidate the way I or enhance the way I'm thinking about things. So we get to that with this Tana Rabbanan. Tana Rabbanan always introduces a Tanaitic source. The Tana Rabbanan says, "Ein omdin litfalel lo mitoch din velo mitoch v'halocha mitoch halocha psuka." That's what the Gemara says. Rashi, you see Rashi halacha psuka, the third line from the top. Sheina tzricha iyun shelo yehei maharher ba betfilato. So I have to assume that this is a statement made for the people in the Beit Midrash. It's not about the people who are out in the field farming. Or or milking cows, I mean, you know, they're not meharher b'dvar halacha. But there was a competition. We haven't got time for this, but you could look into it on your own. There was a competition between Talmud Torah and Tefillah. That, so the Gemara asks, again in Berachot, elsewhere, if I am in the learning something, should I stop to daven? Now, of course, that is implications about whether you think that tefillah is doraita or drabanan. That in a purely theoretical way, if it's doraita, if tefillah is doraita, you should certainly stop learning in order to daven, because the time of davening will pass, and the time of learning will not pass. On the other hand, the spiritual nature of learning is very similar to the spiritual nature of tefillah. That is, just as tefillah, one can say, is placing yourself before HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? That's what you do when you do tefillah. In learning, you also place yourself before HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, this distinction existed until modern times. We'll see in the Nefesh HaChaim. It existed until modern times. The Hasidim said, davening is something everybody could do. And therefore, davening always takes priority. Like Hasidim, even though they don't daven on time, and they don't daven sort of like in an organized fashion, always, but Hasidim will always prefer tefillah over Talmud Torah. The Nefesh HaChaim, I would say, although you could find people disagree, but I would say that the Nefesh HaChaim reduced tefillah to something that you do, right? Something you do, and raise the level of Talmud Torah to the ultimate spiritual experience. Talmud Torah is about placing yourself before HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what it's about. It's not about, there is a subdivision of Talmud Torah, which is, I'm learning material in order to be able to teach it. I'm learning material in order to be a Rav. I'm learning material in order to be a Dayan, right? That's a subdivision of the Talmud Torah enterprise. But in fact, what Talmud Torah is not a, this is only Litvak had this idea. I mean, not that they did it, I'm just saying, but this idea, because of the book that we're going to look at, the Nefesh HaChaim, because of the Nefesh HaChaim, they had this idea that Talmud Torah is a religious experience. And that's why, perhaps, in yeshivas, it didn't matter. There was no curriculum, really, in yeshivas. It didn't matter how many dapim of Baba Basra you learned during the last month. You learned 10, you learned 10. You learned 30, you learned 30. You learned 100, you learned. It didn't make any difference. The only thing that made a difference was devotion. Right? So if a person sat and learned all day, every day, you know, very intensely, he was in. He was doing the right thing. Now, if he didn't know daf nun to pay, okay, so how have I? He's going to learn that, but it didn't lessen his esteem amongst his amongst the others. This idea of knowing things was reserved for the kind of people who had that particular kind of skill. They were able to memorize, to learn, to know. So they became Rabbanim, they became Dayanim, they became Shochatim, which in those days was a learned profession, right, to be a Shochet. But the rest of the people in yeshiva, they were just doing it. They were just doing it. So this distinction is carried on to a certain extent even today, even though today there's an attempt to minimize the distinction between Hasidim and non-Hasidim, for whatever reason. Probably it's the Haskalah, if you think about it. In any event, that's what the Gemara said. You wanted to say something? Somebody wants to say something? Yeah, okay.
Regarding the davening versus learning, what about Otsif and Mitzvah?
Well, you're asking me a halachic question? I'm not talking about a halachic question in a particular instance. Now, everybody has to daven. Everybody has to. But the question is, where do you get your spiritual sustenance from? So the Hasidim get it from davening, and especially davening with the Rebbe. If you could daven near the Rebbe or alongside the Rebbe or even think about the Rebbe, the notion of tzaddikim was developed by Hasidim. Now, tzaddikim doesn't mean he's a tzaddik. It means he is a greater person than I am. And therefore, associating myself with him is good for me. That's what a tzaddik is. Whereas in the literature world, all you had was smart. Right? Now, smart is not always spiritually attractive. You know, it's like a thing. You know, some people are plumbers and some people are drivers and some people are smart. I mean, it doesn't necessarily indicate that there's something that you want to attach yourself to. Right? There's like you have to look into it further. In any event, I don't know how we got to all of this, but we know that this story, the Tana Rabbanan, Tana Rabbanan. You see Tana Rabbanan, the two dots? You see the two dots? Two, that's about 10 lines, no, 15 lines. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 14. 5, 14. The last 15 was not a bad guess. Einom dim litalel, lo mitoch din, lo mitoch dva halacha, ela mitoch halacha psuka. Rashi says, halacha psuka, she'ina, So we said that this is probably taking place in the Beit Midrash. Right? The people in the Beit Midrash have a kind of a problem. Their minds are involved with whatever they're learning. And tefillah demands that they get involved in tefillah. So there was this idea that certain things that you learn are okay. You can learn them and then go into davening. It's not a contradiction. But there are other things that you learn that you have to kind of put them away. You have to put them aside before you davening because they contradict. Now, this is not exactly Kovod Rosh. This is a kind of further definition of what you have to have in mind when you come to daven. So the Gemara says, Lo mitoch din, lo mitoch divar halacha, ela mitoch halacha psuka. Rashi says again, she'ina tzricha iyun. Eina tzricha iyun means that it's the halacha psuka, whatever it is. You know, and then the Gemara quotes two kind of odd hechidami halacha psuka, the Gemara says. Give me an example. Amar Abai ki ader Rabbi Zeirid, Amar Rabbi Zeirid, benot Yisrael echmir al atzvam, shafilu ro'ot tipa dam kechardal, yashrit olev shiva nekiyim. Okay, I don't want to go learn all of Hilchot Nidah just to understand this, but what is the point? What is the point? You take this kind of difficult halacha, but it's okay. It's okay if you like discussing this. Why is it okay? Because it's a halacha psuka. There's nothing to argue about. You can't make a contrary case. So all you could do is learn it and file it away. You learn it and you file it away. And that's okay. That's okay. But again, if you're learning a halakha that has not yet been determined, that is not, you can't say that the halakha is, you can't say that the halakha is fixed. That there's a machloket in the Beit Midrash. People are screaming at each other. That's called iyun, according to Rashi. It's not yet determined. We don't know how it'll get into the Shulchan Aruch. That is going to be a distraction and will not enable you to daven with Kovod Rosh. So this gives you another definition of Kovod Rosh. The first definition of Kovod Rosh had to do with holiness, you know, with a lack of seriousness. This definition of Kovod Rosh teaches you about halacha psuka. And then the Gemara brings another example. Rava amaki hader avoshia, the mavoshia, marima dam al tuato, maknis bemochilo, kidesha de bemtochelet, ptura mina maser. We understand that until a certain point, when you collect the wheat from the field, or you collect whatever's out in the field, until a certain point, you can eat it without being obligated to take Trumot and Masrot. Trumot and Masrot, in fact, are what we call a matir. Trumot and Masrot are very much like Shechita. Shechita, you have a kosher animal, right? The kosher animal is walking around, but you can't eat it. You can't eat it unless you apply to it the matir of Shechita. The same thing is true about things that grow out in the field. There comes a point, the point at which you've collected all the stuff in front of your house, and it's a big pile, and you've topped out the pile, when it needs a matir. In order to eat it, you have to give Trumot and Masrot. So you can be tricky. You can not put it in the pile. You can put it here. You can put it there. But again, in spite of the fact that this is a kind of complex halakha, it makes sense to the Gemara. It makes sense to the Gemara that this is called halakha psuka. And since it's called halakha psuka, it doesn't kind of contradict davening. The third halakha is, Okay, so the third halakha has to do with dam hakaza, right? You take blood out of an animal, so you know that the animal continues to live and it doesn't die. The question is, what is the status of the blood if the animal has been designated for a korban? You know, when you sacrifice the animal, right, you shecht it and then you bring it on the mizbeach, the blood has a certain kind of status, right? The blood is also sacrificed. The question is, before you actually sacrifice it, what is the status of, what is the status of the blood? So the Gemara says it's a halakha psuka. And finally the Gemara says Rabbanan Avdei Kamatnitin, Rav Ashi Avid Ke Braita, right? Rabbanan Avdei. I mean, so it's a question. I mean, you could ask that question, but I would rather not. In other words, it's true that analysis that brings you to all kinds of problems. And why did the Gemara bring these examples and not simpler examples or more obvious examples? It could be that they were learning that in the Braita, when the Braita was formulated, what were they learning in the Beit Midrash when the Braita was formulated? What were the suggestions made by the students in the, you know, I don't know, I have no idea. Tana Rabbana.
Sorry, can you explain a bit more that this Rabbana Navdi, Kedim Matnitin, Rav Ashiva, what you do, right?
Rabbana Matnitin, Matnitin, say, what?
Rashi explains it.
Rashi. Halacha Psuka.
Middle of the Rashi.
Halfway down. Rabbanu Hada Asru Achilat Kem Vedu Rosh. What?
Kemat Kemat Nishim Vedu Rosh.
Yes, but I don't see what's the relation between the two. So Kemat Nishim would be Behira.
What?
The Kovet Rosh.
Maybe where would they differ?
Yes.
Well, what would be the difference between the Paskin like the Mishnah and Paskin like
Is one more machmir than the other?
Two different concepts. So the one, Kobe Rosh, is you have to approach it seriously. The Braisa, when it talks about these examples, is talking about not thinking about something that's going to take your mind off of the tefillah.
Yeah,
there's a distinction. And in fact, you can find the same thing when Yosef talked to his brothers and sent them back to get Yaakov. What did he say? He said, "Al tirguzu baderech." And one of the shot on that is, don't talk about a davar halacha. That's a complicated halacha because you lose your way. Same thing with tefillah. You start thinking about these things, you're going to lose your way, forget where you are.
No, but what are the ones who, if you pass them like the Mishnah, what did you say about halacha psuka?
You allow any kind of discussion of halacha beforehand.
But if it's a distraction, it's a distraction. I mean, like, what is the... In other words, everybody would agree that you shouldn't be distracted, I would imagine. So is it like a biological question, like whether difficulties are distracting or not?
Maybe that's the point, that to be engaged in thinking about Dibrei Halacha, it's not a distraction. That's complementary to Tefillah.
No, but it's not. You see, it's not Patskin in the Rambam or the Shulchan Aruch of this distinction. So that's an indication of something. I'm not sure it means that that if you Patskin like the Mishnah, Mishum Kovid Rosh, you don't Patskin like Halacha Psukah. If you Patskin Halacha Psukah, in other words, you say, give me an example of learning where it doesn't, it's iyun, what the Rashi calls iyun, but it's not going to distract me from davening. I'm going to get up, I'll be okay, I'll be able to, I'm used to it. So would there be a machlokis in such a case? Maybe.
What's this little bit at the end, what's it telling us? Why do we care what Rav Ashi said?
Is it the concentration that you were
asking? No, it could be that according to Tanakama, a person who could wear tefillin and create the ambience of Kovid Rosh in that way would be able to overcome the problem of learning Torah B'iyun. It's not something with, there's no essential difference between the two positions.
It's almost the same.
Yeah, I would say.
If you're serious about davening, then you're going to be concentrating on the davening.
The kasha is on Rashi. It is Rashi seems to make it into two different things. But if you didn't have Rashi, I think you could imagine that they're just different ways of saying the same thing.
Except, as Paul says, the Gemara does say that there's a difference in the way they paskened.
Of course. I didn't say that Rashi made it up. But Rashi could have modified it a little, made it a little easier for us. But he didn't. But it's not a halacha that was adopted, you know, this idea. Even though... okay, let's go on a little bit more. What?
Tosfot also makes a distinction.
Yeah. Tosus quotes, if you look at the Tosus, you see Rav Ashi, Avet Kibraita. I mean, it's always interesting, Rabbanan against Rav Ashi. Isn't that what it says in the Gemara?
Mm-hmm.
So Rav Ashi, Rav Ashi was the Ma'aseif Lekol HaMachanot, you know, If you go through a sugya, you have Tana and Tana and Amora and Amora and Rav Ashi. And Rav Ashi or Rav Ashi and Ravina, and they kind of summarize the material. Here you have Rav Ashi against the Rabbonon. So Rashi says, the second Rashi. See, Rav Ashi, Ovid Kibraisa, Yushalmi, Lo Yamod Vitpalel Elami Tok Dvar Halacha. In the Tosfot, yes. So there's a Gemara that seems to contradict what it says here. Rav Ashi Avid Kibraita, Lo Yamod V'Yitpalel Ela Mitoch Dvar Halacha. The opposite is true. In other words, so what's the difference between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi? The Bavli is talking about people who are learning Torah all the time, and therefore the Torah that they're learning could be a distraction from their davening. The Rishalmi is talking about people who are not learning Torah all the time. So you want to give them a run-in, right? You want to give them something to think about that would bring them closer to Tefillah. So the Yerushalmi says, Yerushalmi says, Lo yamod lepalel ela mitoch dvar halacha. Omar Rabbi Yirmiya, Osek b'tzorei tzibuch, Osek b'dvar Torah dami. So this is like a shul. Even today, you see the shul. Like, you know, there are people sitting in their seats waiting to start, like, you go to Davin Mincha. There are people sitting in their seats waiting. And then there are people walking around and talking to everybody. The people walking around talking about, they're the Oskim B'Tzorchei Tzibur. They all have some business to attend to, you know.
Kedivrei Torah Dami.
They never, right, Kedivrei Torah Dami. So let's go. One more section in the Gemara. Tana Rabbanan. Ein Omdim, this is another brighter. Ein Omdim L'Talel. Lo mita, here, you see the star, it says it's a Sefta. Yeah. It's a Tesefta. Ein Omdim L'Talel. The Gemara doesn't distinguish the various Tanaitic sources. So if it's a Mishnah or a Braita or a Tesefta, it could always be Tana Rabbanan. Right, but the whoever put in the notes on the side helps us out. Ein omdim l'tpalel lo mitoch hatzvut, mitoch hatzlut, lo mitoch shrok, lo mitoch sicha, lo mitoch kalut rosh, lo mitoch dvarim b'teilim, ela mitoch simcha shel mitzvah. There you go. So, there are two things in this brighter that you have to understand. One is the negative things. Don't daven in a certain state. Lo mitoch hatzvut, lo mitoch hatzlut, lo mitoch shrok, lo mitoch sicha. Okay, some we understand and some are more difficult to understand. But the brayta ends, ela mitoch simcha shel mitzvah. What is mitoch simcha shel mitzvah? So, you know, if you're a Hasidic type, so you say, well, that's every mitzvah. A simcha shel mitzvah is obvious. If you said the simcha of being able to do what a Kodesh Baruch Hu wants you to do. I mean, what greater simcha could there be? So, let's look at Rashi. Rashi explained some of the things before. Sicha, right? You see the Rashi? The word sicha, which means conversation. So Rashi says leitzanut. I mean, obviously Rashi is, it's retrograde, you know. Rashi says, you've got to make it into something really bad. So he said leitzanut. Mitoch kalut rosh. Rashi says, chiluf shel kovid rosh, the opposite of kovid rosh, right? There's seriousness and lack of seriousness. And then he adds and says, mitoch zachut leiv ve attack. Zachut leiv means less and not so serious, not so devoted, not particularly devoted. And attack is is like strength, like applying things in a strong way instead of a sensitive way. But what we're interested in is the next Rashi. Elim mitoch simcha. Listen to this. Rashi says, "Kigon devrei tanchumim shel Torah." What is it that generates simcha? Devrei tanchumim shel Torah. Tanchumim are words of solace. Right? The Torah sometimes says it'll be all right. Right? Very often the Torah says you're going to get whacked. But sometimes the Torah says, it will be all right. And when the Torah says, it will be all right, those are called, according to Rashi, Devrei Tanchumim Shel Torah. Kegon, I'll give you an example, Samuch Ligulat Mitzrayim. Samuch Ligulat Mitzrayim. What is Rashi talking about? The halacha is, Smichat Geula, Litfila, right? We all know that. So when you say there has to be a connection between the bracha Ga'al Yisrael, or Ga'al Yisrael, right? The bracha that we say at the end of after Kriyat Shema, in Shachris and in Mariv, and Shmona Esrei. You shouldn't have anything in between, even though at Mariv we say Kaddish in between, but let's say Shachris. Shachris, we say Ga'al Yisrael. Then we daven Shmona Esrei. So smichut geul. Why do we do that? Why did we arrange the tefillah that way? Of course, we have to say Kriyat Shema. That's a mitzvah min haTorah. But we say Kriyat Shema uBirchotecha. Right? There are brachot that somehow go along with Kriyat Shema. So whatever the purpose of those brachot is, right? We only know about Birkot Mitzvah and Birkot Shevach V'Hodayah. So whatever those brachot are, there's another aspect to them which is Smichat Geula L'Tefillah. Right? Another aspect of those brachot. Now, what is the reason for Smichat Geula L'Tefillah? Because Geula is about Geulat Mitzrayim. Right? Geula is about Geulat Mitzrayim. We got out of Mitzrayim, right, on our way to Eretz Yisrael. So that makes us feel good to think about that. And that leads us to Shemona Esrei. That leads to Shemona Esrei. And then Rashi says, oh, Samuch lehitila leDavid, shehu shel shevach v'tanchumim. Or, when we daven mincha. Right? How do we daven mincha? We say Tehillah leDavid. We call that Ashrei. Right? We say Ashrei. Now, what does Ashrei include? Shehu shel shevach v'tanchumim. Ashrei is a collection of psukim that include the motif of shevach, of praise, and tanchumim, which is solace. Right? Kegon, the resh of Ashrei, right? It's an acrostic, an alphabetical acrostic. Ritzon Yireav Yaseh. Ritzon Yireav Yaseh. HaKadosh Baruch Hu pays heed to what those who fear him do, say. Shomer Hashem et kol ohavav, right? Shomer Hashem et kol ohavav in Ashrei. That God, so this makes us feel good. These tanchumim make us feel good, and that's why we place them before we daven Shemona Esrei. Now, there may be all kinds of reasons for saying Ashrei, right? The Gemara says you should say Ashrei three times a day. Maybe all kinds of reasons that we say Ashrei, but this is another reason. In order to make sure that there is Simcha Shel Mitzvah, before you say Shemona Esrei, which is Tefillah, before you say Shemona Esrei, according to Rashi, you have Shevach v'Tanchumim. Right? And the Tanchumim are, it'll be okay. And it'll be okay makes us feel good and happy. And that enables us to daven mitoch Simcha.
I might be able to understand this, Rashi. If the Gemara just said, El Ela mitoch Simcha. But the Gemara says, El mitoch Simcha shall mitzvah.
All right.
So I don't understand the Rashi.
All right, push it. Push it a little bit.
The fact that I'm being stolen at the Ula L'Tfila, so I'm fulfilling that mitzvah, so that makes me happy?
No. Simcha shall mitzvah. Yeah. That the Tanchumim are included in the Tfila. Just like we understand, that I think we pointed out, that after you finish Shemona Esrei, you add these tanchumim, tachanun, right? So before you daven Shemona Esrei, you also add them. That's what the Rashi says. Let me just see if we're finished with the Rashi. Are we finished with the Rashi? Sicha. Ke'egon mikrot asterot b'tfilat arevit, ki lo yitosh Hashem et amo v'chayotzei bahem. Right? In other words, the Rashi says it's a phenomenon. We paskin that you need simcha. Okay, you have a kasha. Simcha shel mitzvah, or simcha before the mitzvah. There is some kind of, I agree. It's not perfect, but you know how it is. Rashi created the text of the Gemara. The Gemara is what Rashi says the Gemara is. That's a starting out position.
Rashi had a different gear.
It's not just girsa, it's also explanation.
Yeah, totally.
It's all the tradition of understanding the Gemara is Rashi.
Tosfos puts them both together.
Who's them both?
Tosfos in the Tosfos, the Ramasku, Rabbanan Abik Masnishin. he says you need both Kovid Rosh and Simcha Shel Mitzvah.
Okay.
He uses that term. So they're both, they're not separate, they're interconnected.
No, I understand, but Rav Ashi didn't say that about Simcha Shel Mitzvah. Rav Ashi only said it about the Halacha Psukah.
Right.
So that certainly makes sense. But you see, I mean, like the Rashi is against creating simcha in some kind of a physical way. Like, he doesn't think that simcha would be derived by having a book of jokes, that you read a few jokes before you start davening. He says simcha is, like, there is this natural emotion called simcha. And simcha comes about when things seem to be as they should be. So the greatest disconnect, I mean, it's almost Tisha B'Av, right? The greatest disconnect between the Jewish people and God is galut. So galut produces unhappiness because it's a disconnect from God. So on that basis, what would produce happiness, joy of some kind or another? A reconnect. And that reconnect comes through the Tanchumim. And Rashi, I mean, this is a programmatic Rashi without a doubt. He said that's the way Chazal organized the davening. That's the way we are kind of directed to daven. And it really answers a question. I mean, it's a question that anybody should do. What are we so obsessed with saying, talking about Yitziat Mitzrayim and tzitzis and after the mitzvah of Kriyat Shema? I mean, why did we obsessively put it in? And then the Eves, V'yatziv, V'rachov, I mean, all of this stuff. Why don't we just get on to Shmon Esrei, which is the main part of davening? And as we've done the mitzvah of Kriyat Shema, now we'll do the mitzvah of tefillah. But somehow, the tradition and the halacha and the determination includes Yitziat Mitzrayim. That's what Rashi says. It includes Yitziat Mitzrayim. And the reason that it includes Yitziat Mitzrayim is that what causes the kind of simcha that the Gemara is talking about. But now, I understand if somebody says that, you know, a little schnapps helps with the simcha. I mean, it's hard to argue the case. But Rashi, probably, who made wine for a living, probably would not suggest that you do that. For Rashi, this was good enough, I think. Okay. Okay, I want to look at the Nefesh HaChaim. Or a kind of a lojener whose name was Itzkovitz. I think he was born. I have this very good, I think. I have this very good article which you can get in. You could download from the Hebrew version of the Wikipedia. Here's I just want the dates. He was born in 1749. And he, the interesting point, I called Professor Stamfer yesterday to ask him because I wasn't sure. He knows about yeshivas. He's also a student of mine once. Rav Chaim Volozhiner was born and grew up in Volozhin. And in Volozhin at that time, the Rav of Volozhin was the Shagas Aryeh. And the Shagas Ayah either had a yeshiva or didn't have a yeshiva. You know, in those days, the 18th century, there were no yeshivas. There were no yeshivas. I'll tell you what that means in a minute. But there was a Rav. And if the Rav was a serious Talmud Chacham, he would attract young boys or young men to learn with him. And he would give Sheurim. And if they lived in the town, so they stayed at home. No, they lived at home and they went to the Sheurim. It was given by the Rav Ha'ir. If they came from another city or from a smaller place to a bigger place, so then the people in the town took care of it. Now, whoever could would put up a boy, and if they needed a little bit of money to do it, so somehow they collected the money, and that's how it worked. And the outstanding students would go from one Rosh Yeshiva to another, or to get the, you know, idea of how different Rosh Yeshiva operated. Now, the Shagas Aryeh is like the classic Litvak, is the Shagas Aryeh. If you look at the book that the Shagas Aryeh, it's called Shaz and Shuvah Shagas Aryeh, but they're not really responsa. He made up the questions. He made up the questions and he wrote the answer. So the Shagas Aryeh is like the ultimate Litvak. You know, even today, he's considered to be the ultimate Litvak. There's a minhag also that bar mitzvah boys, when they become bar mitzvahs, say, you know, you ever go to a Lubavitcher bar mitzvah? You know, so they have some little kid who says something in Yiddish or doesn't know what he's saying, but he's memorized it somehow. So Litvaks are not into that. Litvaks want the kid to know what the Shagas Aryeh said. So I have a grandson who's becoming bar mitzvah in Rosh Chodesh Elul. He's going to say at least part of a Torah of a tshuva of the Shagas Aryeh. It's a minhag that the kids who are like into learning, who like that kind of thing, say over something from the Shagas Aryeh, even though, of course, no one else knows what he's talking about. But it doesn't matter. At least he's not saying anything wrong, you know. So the Shagas Aryeh was the first Rebbe of Rav Chaim Volozhiner, because Rav Chaim Volozhiner lived in Volozhin. And so it was obvious he would go to that. Then he left Volozhin and went to be a Talmud of Rav Rafael Hamburger, who was also a great genius, and he lived in Minsk. He was a Rav at that time in Minsk, before he went to Germany. So, and then only after that, when he must have been about 20, he became a Talmud of the Gaon, of the Vilna Gaon, who he considered to be his Rebbe. I mean, he was the greatest influence on Rav Chaim Volozhiner was the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon, apparently, I mean, you know, it's hard to know, to distinguish the stories from the real. But the Vilna Gaon apparently didn't do anything except learn. He didn't even talk to people. You know, there was just no point. And when Rav Chaim Volozhiner came with his brother. He had an older brother who died young, who was supposed to be more brilliant. It's always that way, right? The more brilliant one always dies. And that's what they say, the brother was more brilliant than Rav Chaim Volozhiner. So Rav Chaim Volozhiner came to say, he says, I want to study with you, he says to the Vilna Gaon. So he said, what are you learning? So he said, Masechta Shabbos. They said, okay, tell me every machlokas of Abai Verova in Masechta Shabbos, page after page, without looking. And he did. And so he became a Talmud of the Gaon, which didn't mean that you went to class or anything. It just meant you sat around, and from time to time you heard something interesting, you know, that the Gaon was prepared to share with the people who were sitting around. Then, eventually, the Gaon died, and here there's a difference of opinion. Rav Chaim Volozhiner went back to Volozhiner. He also became a Rav, the Rav in Volozhiner. But he decided to start a yeshiva. It was a new thing, it was a revolution. It's very hard to understand de facto that what he did was totally revolutionary. And supposedly he asked the Gaon, he consulted with the Gaon, and the Gaon told him to do it, you know, which of course is like, you know, who knows? Maybe he did, maybe he didn't, because there was no indication that the Gaon was interested in yeshivas of any kind. The Gaon was in a different world. You know, the Gaon was in his own world. You know, I've told often this story about the Vilna Gaon asked the Dubna Magid. The Vilna Gaon asked the Dubna Magid to give him Musar before Rosh Hashanah so he could do tshuva. So the Dubna Magid thinks to himself, he says, what am I going to say to the Gaon? All he does is sit and learn. I mean, what sort of Musar can I give him? So finally they met, the Vilna Gaon and the Dubna Magid. The Vilna Gaon is waiting to hear the Musar. So the Dubna Magid said to him, look, let's go day after day during the past year, and I want you to tell me how many minutes you bottled on each day. So he said, Aleph, Tishrei, 1 minute. You know, Beis Tishrei, 30 seconds. So he went through until he got to Kislev. They got up to about 5 minutes, and the Gaon supposedly burst out crying of how much he had bottled during the past year. So it was definitely a coup for the Dubna Magid. I mean, it was like a brilliant move. So Rav Chaim Volozhiner was a revolutionary. What did he do? What was the revolution? I told you what a yeshiva was like before. He created an institution where the institution was responsible for the Talmidim. There was a dormitory, and there was a lunchroom, and he was responsible. He had to raise the money to make sure that this worked. And in order to, like, what was the payoff? Why did he do this? You know, what did he get in return? What was wrong with everybody going to the Shagas Aryeh and learning with the Shagas Aryeh, going with whoever, with the Rabbonim in different cities and learning with them? The payoff was that he wanted to teach the boys that spirituality is connected to Talmud Torah, which is something that they did not get if they haphazardly went from one Shia to another and heard things that were very clever and very interesting, but they didn't get this idea. So in Volozhin, for example, the learning Torah never stopped. The boys were divided into three groups in Volozhin, 8 hours, 8 hours, 8 hours, and the Beis Medrash was always filled. They were always learning in the Beis Medrash, and those 8 hour people switched all the time. Now you understand, obviously, that if you do this, if you made this system, a lot of the boys in the yeshiva are not going to go to Shir, because you're not going to give the Shir three times. You did the Shir in the morning, right? So that means that people stayed up all night learning Torah are not going to be in the Shir in the morning. So what else did Rav Chaim say? Well, I said, look, I'm very smart. I know how to learn. I know what the Gemara is saying. But I think it's more important that you should stay up all night and learn Torah than come to my Shir. That was a novel idea. That there's a world of Talmud Torah, that is not necessarily connected to excellence. Even though, I'm not saying there was no excellence in Volozhin by the time of the Nesiv. In the time of Rav Chaim Volozhin, it's a little hard to know. That's what I asked Shaul Stanfer about. He's the expert on Volozhin. But by the time of the Nesiv, I thought, there were a lot of outstanding Talmidim. This idea of keeping the learning going day and night was gone, right? Because the Rosh Yeshiva were actually more important. That's one thing that he brought into the world, which the extreme position that he took, that people should learn all day and all night, that may have died. But the idea that people should learn all day and all night, that certainly did not die. That certainly did not die. It's part of the yeshiva kind of catechism. You know, yeshiva guys, yom lo, even if they don't do it, they think it's the right thing, that it's the right thing to do. That's one thing. The second thing was, I said, he fed everybody. Also, there was no bein hazmanim in Volozhin. There was no such thing. You just kept learning. You just kept learning all the time. You went from the beginning of the Masechta to the end of the Masechta. You just kept doing it. At the same time, he did not train Rabbanim. He wasn't interested in that fear, but he was the Rav. He was the Rav in Volozhin, and he wrote Tshuvot, which are printed in a book called Chut HaMishulash. Right, that's Rav Chaim Volozhin. So, Rav Chaim Volozhin was caught in this conflict between Hasidim and Mitnagdim. And the person who stood, at least the way we have it now, at the head of the opposition to Hasidim, was the Gaon. And the Gaon, as we said, was Rav Chaim Volozhin's Rebbe. So where did Rav Chaim Volozhin stand on this machloket between Hasidim and Mitnagdim? Well, you don't have to wonder, because he wrote a book about this subject called Nefesh HaChaim. That's the book that he wrote. Now, the first three parts of the book are more philosophical, I would say, but the fourth part of the book, Shaar Dalet, is about the dispute between the Hasidim and the Mitnagdim. And the way he puts it is that there are some people who think, there's some people who think that you could take any sefer, you could take a sefer of Musar, right, say, be good, be good, be good, and you could look at the sefer of Musar and like you could kind of get into a state of ecstasy looking at that sefer of Musar. And that's called being frum. There are people who say that. And Rav Chaim Volozhin said that. The only way to do, the only book that can make you frum is the Gemara. Gemara, Rashi does. He says beferish. It's not like I'm not interpreting his words. These are the words that he uses. Gimel pei taf, right? Gemara, perish Rashi, tosus. That's the only entree to spirituality that the Jewish people have. And anybody who wants that kind of result has got to get it from learning Gemara. Rav Chaim Volozhiner said, okay, if you want to learn a little Musar before you start learning Gemara, like every day, you want to get into the mood, you want to, like, you know, wash your hands or something, you can do that. But it's only introductory, not extremely important. You've got to get to learning Gemara. So on the one hand, Rav Chaim Volozhiner defined the distinction between Hasidim and Mitnagdim in a particular way. On the other hand, as has been pointed out, he did not come out against Hasidus Bitsura Mifereshet in an obvious way. He didn't say Hasidim are this, Hasidim. He didn't get himself involved in that fight. He was purely, like, he was a theoretical person. By the time of the Netziv, until the end of the 19th century, all kinds of people came to Volozhin. People came from with more Hasidic background, less. There were people who wore shtreimels, who were in Bechlal, in the liturgy yeshiva, in the literacy yeshiva world. So that's what Rav Chaim Volozhin said. And one of the things that Rav Chaim Volozhin deals with, of course, is tefillah. And so I chose this, there are many, many chapters, but I would like to look at it with you. Just one second. And the next thing that we will look at, also besides the Nefesh HaChaim, is Rav Chaim Brisker. I just want to make sure you understand the history. That Rav Chaim Brisker, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, yes? He is Rabbi Soloveitchik of Boston's grandfather. He was. And there are people who say that he had a very determining effect on Talmud Torah. I don't know how you make that judgment, but I know what those people are saying. Now, Rav Chaim Brisker was a Ram, a Rebbe, in Volozhin, as was his father before him. And he, even though they were related, didn't get along with the Netziv. And the Netziv won. And Rav Chaim exiled himself back to Brisk. It was when his father died, his father had exiled himself to Brisk, the big city, big Jewish city. So Rav Chaim and Rav Chaim, the son, exiled himself from the yeshiva to Brisk because he didn't get along with the Netziv. Even though the Netziv, on different occasions, admitted that Rav Chaim was the more brilliant. But the Netziv thought he should run the show, which is often often a problem with shows. Okay. In other words, Shar Beis Perek Aleph, you see? The Nefesh HaChaim. So he wrote this, but now that one of the startling things about this book, Nefesh HaChaim, is his use of the Zohar. Now, you all know that the Vilna Gaon was very attached to the Zohar. And he wrote a Perush, which is published on a part of the Zohar, Sefer Tznius'ot, where the Vilna Gaon wrote this Perush. Rav Chaim Volozhiner knew the Zohar Baal Peh. I mean, it's absolutely remarkable. Every page, literally, of the book called Nefesh HaChaim, there's a quote of the Zohar. Every page. So something happened over time, and the Zohar became a book that became unacceptable as a part of yeshiva learning. I never heard of anybody in yeshiva learning the Zohar. I mean, it could be that there are people who are in yeshiva who learn a little bit, look at it, but no one of yeshiva repute today quotes the Zohar. The closest they come is they would say, Muvah basvarim akdoshim. Did you ever hear that? There's such a kind of quote, like, I won't tell you where it is because you might go and look, and then who knows what will happen to you. But it's like an authentic source, you know, like that's what people say. So the Zohar became X'd out. And it's from Rav Chaim Volozhiner, who wrote a book on which the Zohar was quoted on every single page until the Netziv. When Netziv wrote, you know, this his very well-known Perush on Chumash, which doesn't quote the Zohar, here and there, very rarely, you see that there was a change that took place. Right? The Hasidim continued to, at least the Rebbes or the intellectuals, continued to quote the Zohar as a basic text, and the Mistagdim kind of pushed it away. And what their attitude was to the Zohar is a little hard to tell. But de facto, whatever the reason, they didn't learn the Zohar. And even if they thought that learning Kabbalah was dangerous, if it was really important, I think they would have done it. If they thought that they couldn't live without it. But they lived without it. Okay, so here we are. Sefer Nefesh HaChaim, Shar Beis Perek Aleph. You can look at, there have recently been several translations of the Nefesh HaChaim into English. Years ago, Rabbi Lam wrote a very good book on, he called it Torah Lishma. Torah Lishma, that's the point of, the Nefesh HaChaim is that the ultimate experience of Dveikut. Dveikut, what does Dveikut mean?
Cleaving to God.
What does cleaving to God mean?
Getting really close.
Yeah, who knows? In other words, it's like a way that I say the religious experience. Religious experience is that I feel the closeness of God. Right? I feel it somehow. It's sui generis. Like you can't convince somebody else that you feel it, but you're absolutely confident that you feel it. Right? That's about belief in general. It's not easily transferable. But there's no kasha. You can't ask a kasha on it. You can't say, well, you know, if God didn't talk to me, so why should I think he talked to you? But that doesn't bother you. You don't think even God is present. So the Nevi Shechaim says this. L'avod Hashem l'kechem l'avdo b'chol v'avchem k'ol nafshechem v'omar zal eizo yavod shvalei v'avim eizo tfila. Hinei ha'ava שאמר שצריכה להיות בכל לב, הוא פשוט. הוא פשוט. כי הוא ממצוות התלויות בלב. אהבה, love, has to be with a full heart, and it's פשוט. It's something that everybody can do, because it's being מצוות התלויות בלב. You don't have to buy an esrog, you don't have to get a matzah. Everybody has a heart. וכך, וכן עניין אהבה, b'chol nefesh. And similarly, we can speak about love with the entire soul, shamar, that is stated above. Haynu af gam limsor nafsho alav yitbarach shemo ma'otzim lifleit avoda lo yitbarach u'kimo shekatu b'parasha harishona v'ahavta et Hashem v'chay b'chol v'afkoch alav shekha v'chulei amnam b'feirish zeh chidush hu shechidshak. There is something special about this formulation. Shegam ha'avoda hi nitpale tzricha liyot b'kol lev u'b'chol nefesh. That davening tefila has to be b'chol lev u'b'chol nefesh. U'l'achi nami lo k'tiv b'kol ma'od b'chem b'feirish zo kimo b'parasha rishona d'chtiv b'name בכל מאודך, כי פרשה ראשונה מראה מעניין מצוות האהבה לחוד. The first section of Shema is about אהבה. שייך לומר שתהיה אהבה גם בכל מאוד, with all of your kind of power. And that, the Chazal say, is ממון. כמו שכתבו רזל, אם יש לאדם שממונו חביב עליו מגופו, בכל מאודך, אבל פרשה הזו דכתיב נמי עבודה היא תפילה, לא שייך עלה כל כך, ובכל מאודך. Okay, that's a common. I want you to feel is the difference between the Mishnah and the Gemara. The difference between the Mishnah and the Gemara, I think, and the Nevi Shechaim, right, which is only 1500 years. More or less, right? That in the time of the Mishnah and the Gemara, it was obvious to everybody that one could daven. It was obvious to everybody that the experience of tefillah was somehow available. That it was something that you could do. So what is it that we're worried about? We're worried about denying that experience. What will prevent me from having that experience? Like if I relax, if I'm normal. So, Kovod Rosh is defined. Kovod Rosh is defined as don't be too serious, don't be too happy, don't get distracted. Don't get distracted even by good things. Don't get distracted. That's what. Because if you would ask anybody, in the world, is it possible to stand before God? I mean, it doesn't matter what that anybody looks like or what he adheres to or what his religion is. I mean, those they talk about people, all of whom had a religion. They all had a religion. If you ask anybody in the world, can I do this? Can I daven? Can I whatever you say? Can I pray? They would all say, absolutely. There was no machlokas about it in the world. So the Mishnah says, that the issue is how do I avoid being distracted? And avoiding being distracted, you know, could be, I could say it in a positive way, COVID Rosh. I could say it in a negative way, according to Rashi, Iyun. Iyun, that's distraction. I could say it in a different positive way, telling jokes, and we see that there was a lack of clarity about what distraction means. But what if I take telling jokes while wearing tefillin? Does that make a difference? Or does it make a difference in terms of my definition of distraction? Well, by the time we get to the Nefesh HaChaim, the original assumption no longer exists. The original assumption that you could just daven, that God is there, waiting for you to kind of attach yourself to God. That is no longer correct. That is no longer correct. No longer obvious. I don't mean correct. I mean, that would be the wrong... It's something that has to be achieved. So the Nefesh HaChaim says, V'ahavta es Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha b'chol nafshecha. You have to work at it. That's what you have to do. You have to work on the relationship, which is defined by the word v'ahavta, and therefore we go into a new world. We go into a new world, and today I think that this becomes a major issue. It becomes a major issue. I think that in the world of the Orthodox world. In the Orthodox world, in the halachic world, I don't mean Orthodox, I like to say halachic, in the halachic world, we hide behind the rules. This is not to say that I think the rules should not be adhered to. I like the rules. I'm in favor of the rules. But I'm saying it seems to me that the rules can become a distraction. That the rules are going to say, like, I begin to get so focused on the rules that I am no longer thinking about what I'm doing. And even though it's not Iyun, because all the rules, somebody knows the answer to the question, what's the rule? It's not like you're discussing the rule. You just have to find out, you know, in the morning. You have to find out what time is Alos HaShachar, right? But it's not something that, there's no Iyun. You just look in your phone and you find out what time Alos HaShachar is. But you have endless numbers of rules which determine the goodness of the davening. In other words, here they daven with many, many rules, and here they don't pay attention to a couple of rules, so you assume that it's better here than it is there. And that might be true, but it does not answer the question of what davening is. Does not answer the question of what davening is. Okay. So what we're going to do tomorrow is Thursday, we'll learn a little more Gemara, and we will learn the rest of Nefesh HaChaim and Rav Chaim Brisker, right? So you know more or less how it goes, Rav Chaim. There's the Mishnah and the Gemara, the Nefesh HaChaim, Rav Chaim Brisker. Okay. If there are questions or comments.
You suggest something for us to review before?
Well, what?
Do you suggest something that we look into before?
To prepare?
I said the Nefesh HaChaim, the continuation, there are two sections of Nefesh HaChaim, right? A little bit more of the Gemara. And Rav Chaim, there's the...
Do we have Rav Chaim?
The first thing, you have it, yes, you have it. You have it. Here. It's on page 29. Yes?
Yeah.
Now, you really only have to learn the first part. I don't know. It's like, I take it back. I retract. Just learn the whole thing. Just the two columns. Page 29. That's the literature breakthrough in davening. Okay. Have a good time tomorrow.
Thank you.
I have to go to a drugstore.
Well, now you have something to go with.
It's no joke.
Yesterday was a very emotional day. Yeah. Yesterday my brain was like, so before I took, like, yesterday I was scoring, I think on my yeshivish, like 90-95% of what was being said. Today it's more like 70-80% of what's being said.
Okay.
Just because I'm a little
tired.
That's one of the biggest, well, I mean, you did you grow up from?
Sort of. I grew up, my mother came from a very Fung family. She herself was not Fung, but we were surrounded by a family. So my immediate family is not observant, but I was totally exposed to it.
Right. It's always a bit, I mean,
I became Fung when I was 17.
Yeah, I became Fung at 19, but there's always a, every time I go to a different organization, there's always a bunch of words. Everyone's acting like they know, and I always feel like I'm the only person who doesn't know them.
That's not necessarily the case. People may be afraid to ask.
Well, that's the thing, is I once went to a shiur on Shavuos, and it was a very yeshivish heavy shiur for Upper West Side of New York. And I came home, my roommate said, what did you think of the shiur? And I said, I understood about 70% of it, I think. I thought it was really interesting. I had some follow-up questions, but I couldn't ask them because I wasn't totally sure. And she said, well, why didn't you say something if he was talking really, really above your head? And I said, because I'm embarrassed. Everyone else is getting it. And she said, how many people in the room? I was like, I don't know, like 30, 40. And she said, do you think everyone in the room understood what he was saying? If he was talking above your head, you're not an idiot.
Yeah.
He probably was talking about some other heads too, but they were also too embarrassed. So you should ask.
Yeah.
But it's so much harder than in web people where you just type it into the thing. So you're like, okay, Beth said something. I didn't understand what she said. Because you're a master.
No.
Of the
not at all.
Of the yeshivish language. And you would ask a question that was like, what about blank blank? And I'm like, I don't know what that is. Quick, what is blank blank?
I'm going to address that when I want to join Ben to learn.
Okay. Sure.
Because it's all in Hebrew and I'm not comfortable doing that. Translating it.
Hello?
Practically speaking, you know, for example, somebody's working in an office building and they happen to have a minute there, say at 1:30, for 10 minutes or 15 minutes in the middle of their work day.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, you know, you're breaking away from, you know, from your work, you know, the job, and a lot of times you have things on your mind from your work. So what are you supposed to do? So if your mind is totally, your body is still in the office while you're trying to daven. What are you supposed to do? Not daven?
It gets even stronger, right? You have the Mishnah elsewhere in Brachos about the chassan being patur from kriyas shma, right? And then the Meforshim quotes from today that's not even okay today because nobody has kavanah.
Right, but that reason you can understand, you know, a little bit more that he's patur. Like Lolenu was somebody, you know,
no.
Karobish, but that right, don't. So, you know, so you're not way up in, slow.
But you know, something as someone who recently experienced that it was harder not to do the mitzvah.
You're thinking about it.
Because I was thinking about, okay, am I supposed to say a bracha now, or am I not supposed to say a bracha now?
That's what Robert just said at the end of the year.
Right, the rules.
About the parade and the rules. Finding
Right. What I put down, I summarize that as we concentrate on how to do it, not what we're doing.
Right.
So, but what if you are, you know, my whole thing was, okay, how am I supposed to serve Hashem at this point in my life?
There are a lot of ways.
There wasn't a lot of ways. As an owner, there's not a lot of ways. It's all supposed to be directed towards the burial.
If your mind is tarot, right, then and you can't have your head.
Once I had everything in place, several conditions taking care of the funeral.
Right.
My brother is coming up on a train.
Right.
I have nothing else to do.
Right.
Why couldn't I go to, you know, do the mitzvahs that you normally do?
Maybe you,
because the rules say otherwise.
Maybe you in particular.
Sure.
Maybe you in particular, you know, felt that
way.
The community would be able to stand by.
No one thinks that it's promotional, as we don't do what they're saying.
We're talking about if your mind is distracted, let's say you're somebody who's working from 9 to 5, right? And in the middle of the day, in their workplace, there's a minion for a mentor, right? They just came out of a tough meeting or something, and your mind is still on what happened at the meeting, so how are you supposed to concentrate on davening then? Mm-hmm. So here, you know, here it says that if you can't concentrate, it's better not to daven. Or if you tried to daven, but you didn't do the kavanah, you're supposed to repeat the daven. So I asked, I said, how many people do you know actually do that? I mean, it's not practical. You're going to daven twice, you're going to try to force yourself.
The Rambam says otherwise.
Yeah. Right.
In fact, he says, you know.
But we're trying to bring it to today, you know, like what's practical in terms of Kavanah. Better to not daven with Kavanah and daven with Tzibur, or even with Tzibur, or is it better not to, because you're not going to do it right?
But what if davening with a Tzibur makes it even harder for you to daven?
You can't keep up.
In most of the shuls I've gone to since I've been in Israel, I've almost given up saying more than one Kaddish. Because according to many poskim, I'm not being yotzei because everyone's at a different pace. Half people, you know, I don't think I have a minion answering, as opposed to the poskim that I normally follow, which is to say it together at the same pace and everybody can answer, or one person says it at a time. And that's just kaddish. Davening is even worse. So is it better to daven at home without a minion than to go to the minion?
Well, if I'm not going to be Yom Kaddish anyway, by the way, I think the halacha, don't quote me, but I remember Rav told me this when I was sitting when I was in bed with my father many years ago. He said to me that the obligation for saying Kaddish is once a day.
You have to obsess about the fact that if you don't say eight times, I'm fine with saying it once. I'm guilty according to somebody.
Right.
May not be going normally followed.
Right.
But somebody must say it, because otherwise the shul wouldn't be doing it that way. And my work schedule at home is the same thing. You know, if I'm in the middle of doing hashkafa and catering, I can't walk out of the kitchen and go to the find a minion.
Well, that's why the jokes are done.
A trick that I found with it, I've had enough that I need to learn. But if I close my eyes, I focus on the words, I actually can hear what other people are saying, and it's easier to go along with that than to
find the context. Right. So, on the times, let's say that I'm not saying it,
yeah.
I'm listening,
mm-hmm.
and I'm hearing four different kinds of
the other pick one that you go. And usually, if you can, we go I mean, the shul that I go to, it was a balagan and the rabbi now makes everybody stand in the morning praise.
Right.
And I post that for the woman section. I mean, being in a loud voice society, so everybody kind of just follows.
Yeah.
So that's not that possible. But otherwise, like here, I mean, this morning we have like two different people going to different
And then the announced about the minyan in the morning, I asked the question, Ashkenaz or Sephard. It looks like it doesn't make a difference.
It does.
And I discussed this with Rabbi Fink last night, or yesterday. The side I was presenting, which is the Ashkenazic side, said you do anything out loud to minhag hamako.
Yes.
So if I'm in a Sephardic place, I have to say the Sephardic Kaddish.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that Amitai was taking Rabbi Vajra Yosef's position, which is you do whatever your minhag is.
Right.
So
and
for Ashkenazim,
I had the other day, which is actually
a So what happens at mincha when I've been leaving? I've paused so that those who need to, even though that's not, it's not I'm following, but that seems to be the minhag hamakom here.
Yeah, it's very common here in shuls that you'll have different people saying different kinds of kaddishes, and they'll learn after a while. For those who don't say the karev mishichei for a party, so that person gashnas and don't say that, they'll stop and wait until that person says. Then they'll continue together, and then at the end,
there's minhag hamakom. Because in Eretz Yisrael, did you say Marita Tal, even though that's not the Nusach of Ashkenaz,
Right, I actually asked about that
the
first day, and I don't want to think who I asked, but I said, if I'm davening Ashkenaz, isn't it Minhag, is Eretz Yisrael the same Marita Tal?
Yeah.
And it was like, I couldn't get an answer from the person, and so... I did think about that.
Well, it's up there on. But there's a difference between the makom and the nusach. It makes it even a little bit more subtle.
Right.
And that's why you have the joke, about well, this is the shul, this is the Ashkenazic shul, this is the Sephardic shul, that's the shul that I don't dominate. And the reason, I don't dominate that shul is because, you can't keep up. Everybody has to pick a shul where you're comfortable with the pace.
That's if you have what to choose from.
Or if you want to know what the scores were in the baseball game last night, you go to that show. That kind of thing, Unfortunately, that's
yeah, if you live in a small enough city, you don't get that luxury.
Right.
So you have to learn some anava to go over the other people. Sometimes that's from the
street.
Yeah, I don't mind.
I don't know, just practically speaking, if we can daven with kavana, is it better to skip davening at all or just to daven without kavana? Certainly if you're in a minyan, you're safer not davening with kavana because all the tefillot go up together if you're in a minyan. So in that case, it's clear that you should daven even though you're not davening with kavana.
Or you think that you can daven at home at the same time as the minyan.
That's right. Right.
If you think daven, there's people that are quiet. So if you're gonna make that, I think one has to make that a minimal amount of
Kavanah. You brought up another interesting point. There are some people, very few people, but you may have encountered this in the minyan that you daven in, that there's at least, let's say, one person in every minyan who, when he says Shemona Esrei, he will verbalize his words. He won't be completely silent. And it's very distracting to the people around. So the question is,
I was in a place once where it wasn't Shemona Esrei, it was Shema. And I was saying it, I didn't think I was saying it that loud, but I could hear myself. But I was interrupting the people in back of me who were talking. And so they said something to me that I was saying it too loud. They weren't saying Shema. I could hear them. And they said I was done too loud.
That's crazy.
I was in the middle of Shema. I couldn't sing it. That was just awful.
And you might get the opposite of that. Here in many Sephardic shuls, they have a minhag that the chazan will say out loud the tefillot, especially Shema. So if you're Ashkenazi, he's used to saying Shema when it's quiet, and he's saying it out loud, and you're trying to. But it happens to me a lot. Sometimes it's up, and you'll start to show it closer to my house, then like I go crazy because I can't concentrate. I wish he would just be quiet, say quietly, you know.
And at least in Seattle, they not only say it, do it loudly, they do it with the Sephardic trope.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to do my Ashkenazic trope quietly to myself, and so I've learned Sephardic trope.
You go there with the concert and see it.
When I first moved to Seattle, I had to learn everything there was about Sephardic because I had to teach it. My classroom was half and half. So I had to teach myself Sephardic benching, because every other day, that's what I had to do in the lunchroom. And the same thing with Tefillah. I had to do my halakha books.
Let's go on.
Yeah.
The Nira.
Did we get the whole first time? The Rapa Rishona, Shuv Eno Tzari, so you need at least for the first one. The Mavor, the Hedya, the Hakavana, and the Tevet, the Rapa Rishona.
That's where
it's our idea. So what's the first one I'm saying is that there's a Rambam that here he says that you have to have the whole thing, and here you, and then it says only in the first.
Right.
Well, yeah. Now we can get to the Nira.
Well, the Nira Lomar, the trade God may have an obligation to them. There are two ways of having Havana on the God. The first one is Havanashel in Shadorim, translating the words, understanding the words themselves. Yisodahu in Havanah. And the foundation for this is the Din of Havanah, the Sheni, and the second, Shechavain, Shehu Omid, the Tzilal, and the Shem, the second. So you have to have Havanah that you know you're standing in front of Hashem Yisbar. So those two elements. One is understanding what you're saying, and second is understanding who you're standing before. Havar v'vara peradalad sham teleshama umahi hakavana chitne dibo kol shavod. And what is this kavana? How do we do this so that we're supposed to concentrate our heart?
Yes, but it's the wrong stop. This is my Google Maps with dots that stay in the same place for some reason. It's a long story, but I got here on time, barely. Again.
Which bus do you take?
I decided to take the 13 because it gets closer, but actually nearer to the 18. So I'm like, I'll walk extra. And then Google Maps is like, I see, like, Google Maps wasn't adjusting for anything. I noticed that it was sort of stuck on where I started and not making any changes based on where I was walking. So I had to reset it, and it was like, you're all the way over here. And I'm like, I knew that already. Where were you? I ought to get some soda or something like me up.
Available, they know Ro'ed that small, cannot see himself or herself standing in front of Hashem and dominant. Ain't that Masir Tilov, if you're not really engaged in the act of Tilov. But right here, you follow me to say, the angle of the Masir, you're actually involved in an action that doesn't have the theme of action for Tilov. In other words, you're not performing. Yeah, right, pretty much. Right.
This helps explain the answers to why one can daven, let's say, in Hebrew, even though they don't understand Hebrew. Because you can, even though you're not yoked to the Pirush Amili, but you can still envision yourself standing before the Shechina, saying the script.
The Shechina that only one of them is good enough? Or is it good enough?
I don't know if we've gotten that far yet, but
it sounds like he's going to be sitting in both. He's saying both things. He's saying if you don't, if your heart isn't available or turned toward God, plus if you can't envision yourself standing in position, then that's not davening. You're really not engaged in the act of davening. You're not having proper kavana, so you're not really doing anything.
What does it mean that I
Right, the question becomes, I'll call a moed, whether it's not a piyuv, but there is a mitzvah.
Right, but then you don't have, there's no,
unless it's vibor.
You still alive, you do a mitzvah without concentrating.
I think if it's Dibor, we say Srihos Kavana because Dibor is not a Maisa. But anything that has a Maisa, right, therefore, I don't think I agree with my little Seder, you have to have Kavana.
Do I have to have Kavana
to pick up a Lulav and Esra on the first day? No?
No,
because if I pick it up correctly, I can't do the bracha anymore. Because by picking it up, I've done the mitzvah.
Is there a contradiction there? Because not having kavana may not mean you can do it yet again. It's like when
I pick it up. Every moment I hold it,
yeah,
it's mitzvah. I just can't make a bracha on it. Because I've already fulfilled, and we do the say the bracha before we do the mitzvah.
And you're good. Yeah, okay.
So too, if I eat matzah at Leil Seder, I haven't said Allah Kilat Matzah. Now someone says, oh, you know, it's Pesach.
If you don't lean to the side, you're leaning.
Leaning is a separate mitzvah. Leaning is Miyakev or not Miyakev. That's a separate mitzvah.
Okay, so I still am pretty sure that you have to...
If I happen to be leaning while I'm eating the matzah,
have you fulfilled
the mitzvah? Have I fulfilled the mitzvah of a Hei Teva?
I think I have the key.
There's a difference between, well, there's a big machloket, as we know, Ayin Mitzvot, Sukkot, Kavanah, Olam, right? With my mitzvot in general.
Right.
But when it comes to davening, it could be that, or specifically with davening, you need Kavanah.
Right.
No, when you're eating matzah or doing, you're making the bracha for anything else,
there
and
are
you
are
don't.
There are certain mitzvot that do require Kavanah.
Okay.
So within
the context of the Taryak Mitzvot, then maybe we can say most of the Mitzvot don't eat Kavana.
If
you just do the Maaseh, you're Yotzei.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so in this case here, we're talking about Tefillah.
Which is Dibur, which is considered not a mach.
Right, but it's still a machloket because not everybody would say, today we'll have our thing. Well, I would ask, you know, but I'm not so sure that every rabb would say that if you didn't have kavanah when you daven, well, daven again.
I don't think anybody
would say that.
Don't say that. If there's rahot, you can go back and you can. say, with Ashrei, you didn't think that the Gedecha was coming up. You can go back to that and think that there's a bracha.
Right.
But the two levels of bracha do not. The only ones that are an exception are Yechatzara and Benjamin.
Right, so there's also the question of, when people are doing tashlumin, if there's a shilas, whether or not I can have kavana one time, now I'm davening two, one after the other, how can I possibly have kavana for that long?
Right.
So how can I do tashlumin? Yeah. But then you definitely are having kavana, whatever that means. The kavanah we're talking about here is the being able to envision Hashem standing before Hashem.
Only that's another
image. That's what says kavanah is up.
The makom shehayam kasek,
you know, kulo.
Oh, kelo bichada. Kelo bichada. Like, if he doesn't do that, if he doesn't do that.
So if you skip words in Davin, it's also another example of why he didn't Davin at all.
So you have to know the explanation of the words. So you said there's two kavanas.
Right.
One a pirush hamilim and one that you have standing with a shtina. So it's that by just standing there. But so now he's saying that if
by knowing you're standing in front of the Shechina, and you're saying words, and you don't know their explanation, right? Because you're standing in front of Hashem saying something.
And knowing the words, it just possesses it.
In other words, he's saying that the understanding of the words is secondary to understanding who you're bowing in front of.
But then he says that
this is only required within. Remember, the question that he's having is, do we have to have kavana for the entire Shmona Esrei, or just the first bracha?
Okay.
That's right.
Remember, that's the right. Issue he's having.
We need to address this in the next sentence also, again. Yeah.
Daven means Kavanah with one's heart. In all the prophets, and if you cannot with all, you have Kavanah with your heart with all of the prophets, you should have Kavanah with your heart.
Is Kelly's at 11:30?